You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
I will love spring again, but not today. Only 7 months since you closed your eyes and never woke. Since I left our bed for a sip of coffee, a bite of muffin. And when crawling in against your warm body, found chest still, breath gone. So it's too soon to feel joy in all this beauty and fruition. Alone in Eden, I ask, how can the world be this bright without you? If you have ever loved someone deeply who's passed away, you understand how I felt on August 3rd, 2013, when my husband stopped breathing. Even though he'd been sick for 6 years, I don't think anyone is ever ready for that moment. I know I wasn't. It's hard enough going through the emotional pain that on some level and days feels like a freight train in my chest. But there's also the realization that he's not coming back, that life will never be the same, and that this life is stretching slowly into forever. Without my family, friends, hospice, and my shamanic journey work, I do not think I'd still be alive, and if alive, I would not be sane. Now, 2 years after his death, I'm beginning to see more light and feel more hope in my life. And writing this book has been part of my recovery. I'm so grateful I can go into trance and do shamanic journeying to receive help from spirit allies, and I can even spend time with my husband in a level of heaven. What a gift to know that the energy between us is alive, that our infinite spirits can commune in a heavenly world. What a gift to know without a doubt that he is immortal and happy, that I am immortal, and so are you.
Dr. Susan Allison is a nonfiction writer and poet and the author of 5 books, Conscious Divorce, Breathing Room, Empowered Healer, Our Spirit's Stance, and her newest book is You Don't Have to Die to Go to Heaven. Thank you for joining me, Susan.
Thanks so much, Rick, for having me.
Susan, this book begins with the passing of your husband, and you say that one of the things that helped you was your ability to go into trance and do shamanic journeys. The way you get into trance is through a kind of a rhythmic sound. What is that sound, and how did you choose it, and how do we choose our own?
Well, I'll go back 22 years to 1993 when I went on my first shamanic journey experience weekend in the Sierras with 12 other women. And the person leading the weekend was trained by Michael Harner. And Michael Harner, I see, is the father of not shamanism, but bringing shamanism to the average person. Michael Harner is an anthropologist who traveled all over the world studying shamanic practice. And then he wrote the book, The Way of the Shaman, and allowed the rest of us to learn from him how to do shamanic journey on our own. So that weekend in the Sierras in 1993 was amazing for me. And we listened to a drum and closed our eyes, and it's really good. I think we had eye masks or scarves over our eyes, but it's really good to use an eye mask that shuts out the light. So I remember lying there on the floor with 12 other women and listening to a drum, a recording of a drum that's a very rhythmic sound that some people compare to a heartbeat, but I believe it's a bit faster than that. And we were able to feel ourselves going into a relaxed meditative state or trance and journeying or spirit traveling to other dimensions, to spirit worlds. And for me, since then, which is 22 years, I use a drum. I use an MP3 or I use a CD that I have that is a rhythmic drumming sound. And it depends on each person. Some of my clients like my voice better, and when I do my book signings that I'm starting to do in January and February, I am going to lead the audience into trance with my voice, and then another trance, have them listen to a drum and do a brief trance journey in that way so that they get used to both. Some people listen to a rattle, and I think that each person can just experiment and see what works best. Some people even use a didgeridoo, and that sound I have also tried, and I liked it, but I prefer a drum, and each person will have to figure that out for themselves.
You talk about shamanism. The history of shamanism is long and studied, and it crosses all cultures. What culture of shamanism appeals to you most?
You know, since I studied with Michael Harner and three other shamans, shamanic practitioners, I would say Siberian shamanism is most resonant for me. And in the book, I quote a couple of authors who have written about Siberian shamanism. And I love the teachings from Siberia. And the Siberian shamans are still practicing. In fact, there are so many countries in the world where we still have shamans practicing. And yes, it has been about 60,000 years, according to Alberto Valoldo, that shamanism has existed, predates all major religions, and I believe is the first religion, is shamanism. The shaman would go into trance by listening to a drum or rattle and close his or her eyes and spirit journey to find information out to help the tribe, to help an individual who perhaps was ill, or to find out where to move next, where the game was. And the shaman was the spiritual leader of the tribe and able to talk to spirit allies in the other worlds and bring back wisdom for the tribe and for individual members.
The shamanic worlds are divided into three different worlds, a middle world, a lower world, and an upper world. Let's talk a little bit now about the middle world, because that's the first place we generally go when we journey. And how do we know we're out of this world and in that one?
In my book, chapter one is devoted to the middle world because I believe it's a bit like an airport or a subway station. And we're able to go there first and then either go down to the lower world, which is not to be confused with hell or the underworld of the Greeks. It is raw nature. It's pristine. It is absolutely beautiful and ancient, primeval. And you can go to the middle world, which is in some cultures is called the sacred garden. In Hawaiian shamanism, it's called... In fact, some people even think it's like the bardo in Buddhist tradition or purgatory to the Christians. But to me, those have some negative connotations that I don't particularly care for. So I like to call it the middle world or your personal place of power. It is the place you can go first and find a realm that is just yours. It does not look like anyone else's. It belongs to you. You can go there for renewal. You can go there for a meditative, peaceful state. And to the Hawaiian shamans, it is a place that people can go once they transition, so that the soul sometimes is confused. And once the person has passed on, has transitioned, the soul knows where to go if this middle world has already been found. And I know that in Hawaii, that the indigenous people of Hawaii still teach people how to go into trance and find their middle world, because it is the familiar, comfortable place to go after death. And you can do it for that reason or for renewal and peace. And you can go to meet loved ones that you invite in. You always say, I am inviting in only beings who love me, and they will come and meet with you there in the middle world. The way that you know that you're there is that, for one thing, you could not consciously think of these places and the things that happen. It is not something that I could sit and consciously think about and create, because it's very, very magical. It is very luminous, especially the upper world. It is a different dimension of reality. And the reason I've written this book is because I want you to go. I don't want you to listen to me. I don't want to be your guru or your shaman or your teacher. I believe that you can go on your own and you can find these worlds, and it's a personal experience of other dimensions, of the divine, and you come back and you believe it because you have personally experienced it. I have no argument with books like Proof of Heaven, Eben Alexander's book, because I feel he opened the door, especially to a lot of people who are scientific and believe in a neurosurgeon's view of heaven. However, why must we believe in what everyone else says heaven looks like? This one person who goes there and comes back and tells us about it, to me, that we're being sheep when we do that. That this is a way for you to go personally and find out for yourself what it's like, and then bring back the wisdom, the guidance, the healing to transform your own life.
You write this book with a particular structure, with parts of checking in, there are poems, there are places to prepare. Talk about creating that structure so that each chapter kind of takes us through the steps we need in this shamanic journey.
I obviously did this on purpose, made the book very experiential, because that is how I learn best. When I go to workshops or read a book, I cannot just have direct instruction where somebody's lecturing or telling me, you know, what they're experiencing, and I'm then to somehow understand it without practice. And so for me, experiential books and workshops work best, and that's how I structured my book, which is that I talk for a bit about a certain world, like the middle world or the lower world or the upper world, and then I have people answer questions in a way that they can understand their feelings about going there, why they're going there. They can write all of this in a journal. Then I actually have a practice where people sometimes go out in nature and have an experience with a great tree before they climb a tree in their journey to the upper world. Or I have people experience something that is actually literally journeying to that world, and then bring it back and then answer more questions about what happened and write about their journey, which I feel is extremely, extremely important to write about our journeys, to have understanding about what happened, since everything that happens in a shamanic journey is symbolic of our own life, and it can teach us how we can change our lives and change ourselves for the better.
Your book talks about researching the spirit world, which I think is an interesting notion. How do you research the spirit world? You've been there, you visited. How do you come back here and research what you've seen in there?
I love research, and so some readers may not love it as much as I do, but I feel that it's so interesting to do a journey, and you go on a shamanic journey, and someone shows up, as they have for me. One of the first journeys I ever took, I went to my middle world, which is a beautiful place in the natural realm. It has a huge tree that Siberian shamans call the Great Tree. It has a river, it has a waterfall, and so on. So one of the first times I went there, there was a man sitting there who had his hair tied back. It was white. And he turned and I saw he was Asian and very, very, very beautiful. And I asked him his name and he said, "My name is Lao Su." And I said, "And why are you here?" He said, "I am your gardener." Well, he meant that symbolically, not literally, that he was my gardener, because I was what he was going to prune. I was the one he was going to teach and mold and help become a better person, become clear about my soul's purpose. So then after that journey, I did research on Lao Tzu, the founder of Taoism. I found out where he lived in China. I found out that he was a magistrate in the government. He became disillusioned with people and how they treated one another. And he was leaving, and when he was leaving the gate, gave the gatekeeper his teachings, which became the Tao Te Ching. I found out so much from that research, but had no idea really who he was. But he suddenly appeared in my journey, which is so magical about journey work, is that these beings come, and then later I do research and find out, aha, this is why he's come to me, is to try to teach me about being more conscious and more elevated as a person. And he became my teacher and my protector for many years.
That leads to a question, because you talk about spirit allies and spirit teachers. Are they the same? Are they different? For example, Lao Tzu, it sounds like he was a teacher for you.
Yes, Lao Tzu was a teacher, but not everyone who shows up in your spirit worlds is a teacher. Some of them are, I call, spirit allies, and they are beings that come, and they're with you for a time, and you do learn from one another, particularly from them, but then they go. And my grandmother was such a person. My grandmother was a spirit ally who came and was sitting in my garden one day, and I had never met her. She was my father's mother, who died before my birth, but here she was in my garden, and she was an ally. She was a confidant, a friend. And I realized how much alike we were, and I would sit and talk with her in my garden. So there are spirit allies who come. There are animal helpers who come in the lower world. You can have teachers, guides, ancestors, and of course departed loved ones, like my husband and my parents, who have appeared both in my middle world and in the upper world that I call a level of heaven.
We've been talking mostly about the middle world, where you meet your teachers and your allies. How do we travel, say, to the lower world, where we would meet the animal helpers?
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of ways that I talk about in Chapter 2 to travel to the lower world. And one way is that you imagine a place in real life, like a cave, or for me, a hollow in an old tree. An apple tree became the first place that I imagined journeying through. So you imagine going inside this hollow tree or this cave or a hole in the earth, and you find yourself in a tunnel, and your goal is to look for the light and to come out, and you come out in this amazing, very primeval world of nature that seems so ancient. That's the lower world, and that is where you ask for an animal helper to come.
That's Alice in Wonderland with the mad,
yeah.
The rabbit.
Yeah, I think that book is a shamanic book, mm-hmm. Alice in Wonderland. You're right.
When you describe the journey, that's exactly what I was thinking was down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, down the rabbit hole, and my place that I go is very much like a rabbit hole in a tree that then comes out in this magical world, and that's the lower world. And for me, the lower world is about working on your character, mm-hmm. your personality, your defects. I had some arrogance when I first started journeying. I wanted a certain power animal. I wanted a certain experience. And my animal helpers, one of them that became a teacher who's still with me, taught me so much about what I needed to let go of, mm-hmm. the personality traits that weren't serving me any longer in order to become a better person. And I think the lower world does that. It sort of polishes our edges.
Talk about the animal helpers, and you also, how do they work as spirit guides, and what's the difference in the way an animal helper works as a spirit guide as opposed to a human or just a spiritual ally that is maybe an incarnation of something that we don't encounter in this plane?
The animal helpers and their spirit allies as well lead you on a journey through that world. And my animal helper that's still with me is the eagle. And I did a lot of flying with the eagle. And in these realms, you are magical. You can fly on an eagle's back. I have flown on a ladybug's back, on a butterfly's back, which is why the front cover of my book has a butterfly. Not only does it represent transformation, but also in the book, I tell a story about flying on a butterfly's back. So it's not unusual to have something like that happen when you are in trance and doing shamanic journey work, that you could magically travel on something that's so much smaller. So a lot of my journeys were on the eagle. And depending on your own journey, a bear may show up. A camel showed up in my very first journey that wasn't my power animal, but was a teacher about humility for me. Because I did not want a camel. I was being really difficult about the kind of experience I wanted and very willful. And I got a camel because I didn't like them. The camel was hissing and spitting and smelly. And I had to realize that this is what was happening. And suddenly the eagle plucked me off the camel and dumped me in a river and then finally poured me into his nest, told me to sit there until I was teachable, until I was really ready to learn from him. And so you can have these experiences with your animal helpers that are going to change you. And really, the experiences over 22 years have changed me forever.
And you cannot just be changed internally by an animal helper. There is, you acquire the ability to shapeshift and become the animal helpers that you have been helped by, in mm-hmm. a sense. How does that work? And how does that kind of transformation, does that change the way you communicate with your animal helpers, or does that just change the way you perceive the world, the middle world, or the lower world?
Well, mostly you are engaging with animals in the lower world, and some people do have, some animals come in the middle world, but mainly it's humans. But in the lower world, the animals are there to guide and to help you transform. And yes, you can shapeshift. I have shapeshifted into an eagle, and I've shapeshifted into a swan, and many other animals. And the whole reason for that is that you become that being. The eagle has the ability to see long distances, to see with clarity, and it's symbolic of then my coming back and having those attributes of the animal, which Native Americans have been doing for centuries, mm-hmm. and the indigenous peoples throughout the world have been doing this for centuries, is sometimes worshiping, but at least identifying with a certain animal, wanting the bear's strength, wanting the ability to go into hibernation or deep inside to find out your truth, wanting to be able to see clearly with clarity what your life is about by becoming an eagle, being able to fly free and know that feeling of freedom that we can have in our lives here. And one thing we haven't mentioned, Rick, is that everything that happens in the shamanic world transforms your life here. Mm-hmm. So that everything that happens there, when you come back here, your life is changed. You have a different insight. You have a different view of life. You have a different view of yourself and your purpose. And so every single thing that happens in the shamanic world is symbolic. So, for instance, if you go and there are weeds everywhere, or one of my teachers once could not even get into her middle world, she kept paddling around in a boat outside and they wouldn't let her in. She had to look at her life and what was going on that was blocking her from mm-hmm. going more deeply spiritually or more deeply into becoming the person she wanted to become. And so every single thing has a meaning. I've gone before to my middle world and the gate is off the hinges. Everything is overgrown and there's nobody there. And finally, when I find someone, they say something to me like, "You haven't been here. you haven't been focusing on this deeper part of your life. You have been flitting around and you have been overly busy. You haven't been focusing on your spiritual practice. You've not been here. You have not been paying attention to something that is more, that could so help you. And it's everything is now overgrown. It's been neglected by you. And so we're not here. You know, we haven't been here.
It's the room of your life you haven't cleaned up in a year.
It's the room of your life. It is everything that you could be working on that you're not working on because you're keeping yourself distracted. Mm. Distracted with diversions, some people with addictions, with over being, I mean, I think being busy is an addiction in our culture. And so avoiding going deeper causes this to happen. When you go there, you find that, yeah, that they've...
It's delusional thought in the Buddhist tradition.
That's right.
What is divination and how does that work in the lower world?
Well, actually, divination is something that in the book I want people to practice in this world, which is that, and it's true in the other worlds as well, that everything has a spirit. Mm-hmm. Everything can talk to us. Everything can, and they don't have a mouth. It's like if you find this beautiful, beautiful boulder that you're sitting on in your trance, the boulder can speak to you in your mind. And so you will have a thought in your mind. And I actually really like the idea of readers practicing it here. So every time you go for a walk, like you, Rick, you know, walking on the beach with your dog, that you turn to the ocean and ask if it has a message for you. That every shell that you see or every rock on the beach, you can turn to it and you can say, is there any message you have? In fact, I never take a rock or shell or other object from nature without asking its permission first. Mm-hmm. And I will hear a yes or a no clearly. Yes, I'd love to go with you. No, I want to stay here. I once took a rock from the desert that told me that yes, it would go with me if I placed it in water because it had been out there in the dry sun for so long. It wanted to be in some water. So I took it home and put it into a pond. So divination work is very rich because we get messages from everything around us. And it is the ancient belief that every single thing has a spirit. And in quantum physics, everything has energy. Mm-hmm. And having a spirit is also what I mean in terms of energy.
Well, it's the idea of reading the world, I think.
Yes, reading the world.
Let's talk about upward travel. How, if you've explained how we can get down to the lower world, but how do we get back up and how do we travel upward? You mentioned before a great tree, and I believe that that's our key to traveling upward.
It has been for me, and I have an entire chapter on upward travel, because there's a beautiful tree in my middle world, in my garden, my personal place of power, is a huge, huge tree, bigger than any tree you've ever seen. It's just amazing. And this great tree is also very present in Siberian shamanism. In fact, the shaman would often put an example of a tree, like a huge branch, inside where they were doing the work so that the community would feel confident that the shaman was going to climb this tree. And he would put an actual tree there and sometimes a ladder. There'd be like a rope ladder or something hanging there to let people know he was going to climb to the upper world and bring back answers. So in my book, I both have explanations of the great tree and the story of Jacob's ladder. So
sometimes I love the story of Jacob's ladder the mystical ladder.
Isn't it cool?
Yeah, there's a wonderful scene in a Terry Gilliam movie where they climb up to the stars, and it's just so beautiful. And that kind of notion that we can do that is really, I think, powerfully embedded in the human experience.
I agree with you. I love the story of Jacob's ladder also. But what's interesting is that in the story of Jacob's ladder, the angels actually came to Jacob. Mm-hmm. Whereas in this work that I'm describing, you would climb the ladder to the upper world. And there's one journey that I call Mount Olympus, because it was one of the first journeys I took, and the place that I ended up looked like Mount Olympus. But what I did was climb a tree in my garden, my place of power in the middle world, climbed a tree to the top, and suddenly a ladder dropped. And I set this intention ahead of time, which I also need to mention that it's important for each journey that you set an intention of what you want to do in the journey. So my intention was to go to the upper world, to climb this great tree, and have a ladder drop. And suddenly this ladder did drop. I climbed it up to this world that seemed to be in the sky. And it looked a lot to me like Mount Olympus in terms of being in the clouds, being above me. And I would climb up, and I found a spiral road leading up to this high place. And there was a guru-like figure, an avatar, an exalted teacher waiting there for me in that upper world. So that is how I often travel to the upper world. And in fact, almost always is by climbing this beautiful tree. Now, however, my eagle comes, or a swan, and carries me to the upper world. I haven't used the ladder in years, but it might be a good way for someone to travel who reads the book and understands that that's a method.
You mentioned your eagle, and you talk about bird helpers and winged snakes. I mean, the ways that we can move upward are associated with things that move upward in our world, and there it's analogous. It's this back and forth crosstalk between our world and these other realms.
Very true. And I also like the idea that you let go of what could come, that you climb the tree and you wait there and you just ask for something to carry you there, and some magical things can happen. I have had a coach, like Cinderella's coach, come. I even had a taxi cab come once. And my husband, Tom, who passed away in 2013, was there with me at the top of the tree one time. He put his fingers in his mouth and whistled, and a taxi cab came careening out of the sky. The back door flew open. We got in and flew to the upper world. It was pretty funny. So I find that the spirits in the spirit world have a sense of humor, mm-hmm. that there are some funny things that happen. I have a friend who does this work, and she has an elevator. And she gets in the elevator.
Oh, that makes perfect sense.
She gets in the elevator, and she can travel up, and she can travel down in her elevator. And for me, it's been a tree, and it's mostly been winged helpers that come.
You mentioned intention before. For each session, you have to set an intention, and you pair that in the book with protection. And I think, to a certain extent, they're almost the same thing.
Yes. So setting an intention is, I would like to travel to the middle world and invite in an ancestor would be an intention. And then you ask to be carried safely and return safely. Now, the reason I do this is not because it's an unsafe practice, because it isn't, but we are, especially when we're traveling to the upper world, we are going through dimensions like the sun. And the sun's energy, some shamanic teachers say, is where we travel through when we transition, that you go through the sun. And I think it's important to realize that you're traveling into other realms, into spirit worlds, and you need to come back. You have a life here. You need to take all the wisdom, all the guidance, all the healing you've received and change your life here. It's so beautiful, especially in the upper world, which we'll talk about in a minute, that at times I've thought, oh, I just want to stay here. This is so beautiful. It's amazing. And some of my participants and clients will go to their middle world and be just lying under a tree on some soft moss. And it's so warm and delicious and perfect. They say, oh, I don't want to come back. I want to stay here. Well, it's not our time. Mm-hmm. And after my husband's death, I often said, I don't want to be here. I'd like to stay here in the upper world. I don't want to be on earth. And I was told over and over, it is not your time. It's not your time. It's your time to be here on earth and trying to transform and change and help others while you're here.
When you talk about, you mentioned this, the sun, and you, in the book, you talk about journeying to the stars and the planets, and you mentioned planetary beings, and I'm wondering, are these aliens or archetypes or something different?
Every time I've traveled to the stars, and my favorite constellation is the Pleiades, and I love traveling there, all I have found there are voices and spirit beings that are invisible. But at one time, I did find myself in an absolute pod of light. I found myself in a room. I traveled down some stairs, found myself in this stone room, and there was light everywhere. I was in the very, very center of this room, hearing voices speak to me about my life, and it was pure light. So for me, the star nation, the moon, is very luminous, and I have never seen beings in the star world. On the moon, however, I did meet with a Celtic moon goddess named Arianrhod, and she has been with me since 1994. And she actually comes to me when I go to the moon. And when you ask about archetypes, yes, I believe that if you did this work, Rick, or the listeners would do this work, would find archetypes there. You would find perhaps goddesses. You would find ancient teachers, avatars, beings that are otherworldly or spirits now, but who will come and be teachers. And so, yes, the moon is someplace I have met archetypes.
We're up in the stars, but you talk about the higher realms. And what I find really interesting is that there are levels of heaven. And so how do you discover those levels? How do you travel between them? And how do you distinguish between them? And is it possible to go to the highest first and then go to the lowest of the higher levels? Or how does that all work?
Yes. For one thing, most shamanic teachers say that the moon and stars are in the middle world.
Mm-hmm.
I disagree slightly because I feel that they're a bit higher, and it's like they're a bridge or a segue to the upper world. So that's why I have you journey to the stars and moon first,
mm-hmm.
before you go any higher. Most of the time, though, when you're trying to get to the very, very uppermost realms, it is best to travel through the sun, through mist. There'll be some barrier. There'll be something, some membrane, something that you pass through to get to the higher realms. And for a lot of people, this is the sun's energy, which for me feels very thick, and as if I'm passing through almost like rubber. And I'm passing through, and it sort of like spits me out into this upper world once I get through that energy. But it's somewhat dense. And a lot of my participants and clients have also described it that way. Once you come out the other side of the sun's energy, for me, there is this place I go. I find myself flying usually on, let's say I'm flying on a swan who comes. The swan is sort of a feminine energy and the eagle masculine, and they go back and forth in terms of carrying me. And I end up in this world that for me has a beach. It has a Greek temple, and everybody's is going to be different. So don't expect that yours is going to be the same. It'll be mm-hmm. different. But my parents are there. Socrates is there, who is in my soul family. And I see my departed husband, my late husband, there in that realm. And you can travel to other worlds from there, other levels of heaven. I am careful to call this a level of heaven, because on one journey I looked up and I saw a golden city. It was a city as described in Revelation that I read after this journey that describes a golden city that's like of crystal with facets of light bouncing off this crystal, whether it's glass or it's windows. But it was a golden city when I looked up. It was breathtaking. I remember actually losing my breath for a minute during the journey when I looked up. I have never been able to go there, but my husband, who is in that realm, and I are able to fly up during the journey and look at it from each side and from underneath, never above, and then come back down to this level where I can go because I'm still embodied. My belief is that this description is correct, that's in Revelation, that there is a heaven that we go to after we have shed these bodies and we are spirits, that we can go there, but not now. I've also gone to other worlds. I've gone to a beautiful, beautiful mountaintop that a friend who is departed, a friend that I love very much, she took me to this mountaintop that was full of snow. I was able to go there with her, and I've been able to visit an ancestor there in another world. So there are levels. I've seen a blue and silver city that had spirits that were mist, sort of like outlines of beings, and I could travel to that world, which is just a little bit above the world where I go. So what I have found is that there are levels, and I do believe in some, and there are Christian religions who believe this, that we progress, that just like we have to progress here, Rick, in terms of becoming hopefully better and better people and transforming and becoming higher and higher higher vibrationally, I believe we're still doing it there.
Mm-hmm.
We're still growing. We're still moving towards the light. We're still traveling through dimensions and realms as we go higher and higher and higher, is what it seemed to me. And when I asked my husband, you know, I was afraid I was keeping him from the light by visiting him so much. He said, no, I don't choose the light. The light chooses me.
I was going to ask if he had said there are places that he has been that he cannot tell you about, or has he just simply not told you about places that where you guys do not visit together?
There are places we do not visit together. And that
you
he
know
could,
that.
Yes, he's told me that. And he also is busy.
Mm-hmm.
He has a job there. Or
really?
More than, yeah, he has more than one job. He is greeting souls. You know, he was incredibly outgoing here. Always the life of the party, just very social, very extroverted. And it fits perfectly that he would be welcoming people. He would love that job. And he sometimes will say to me, I can't really talk right now or spend time. I have to go. I have this thing I have to do, and he doesn't tell me exactly what it is, but off he goes.
Wow, that's so interesting. One of the things you talk about is meeting your own higher self and your soul family. So these seem interconnected. How are they connected, and how do you do that?
In the book, and we're talking about You Don't Have to Die to Go to Heaven, which is my latest book. In the book, I talk about connecting with your own higher self in your heart and meeting this higher being within you. Much as we have an egoic self, we have this ego that talks to us, that tells us things. It is my experience that we also have a higher self that balances the ego. And so I have exercises in the book where you connect with your higher self. Also, once you are doing the shamanic work and traveling, particularly to the upper world, there is a personal oversoul, as some shamanic teachers call it, or your higher self that is there that you could connect with and receive wisdom that comes in, and it comes in through your heart and helps you here on earth. I also have experienced being plugged in, or my essence or my energy, part of a greater energy. And it depends on whether you call this God, or you call it the oversoul, you call it the creative force in the universe, which I particularly like, or spirit or source, there or light or love. I have experienced becoming one with that source or that oversoul. In the book, I have a journey called Becoming Light.
Right. I was going to ask about
that.
Healing of light. Journey of light.
You become light, and it's incredible, where you basically turn into light. during the journey. And there's a merging with all beings. One of my journeys, I was holding hands with like everyone on the planet practically, and everyone in spirit. And there was this connection of love and oneness. We were standing on the earth and we had we were holding hands. And I experienced that during a journey, that there is no separation. We are all one. And I've never felt that more strongly than the upper world, that there is no division, that there's only love, there's only light. And we are part of that love and that light. It's who we are. We're densely packed light.
Being a bookish sort, I was interested in the library and the Book of Light. Book of Life, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and some people who do this work and have for many years call it the Library of Akashic Records. And what I found in that library, and everybody's will be different, but I found my book and my Book of Life. And what was really fascinating is that on the cover was a live oak tree in miniature, of course. It was a wooden book and there was an oak tree on it. And there was a moon and there was a hollow in the tree and the center of the tree. And what happened was I journeyed or found myself being pulled through this tree and suddenly I was in this forest. And from there was able to visit a couple of my past lives. And the book, if you open the book, your past lives are in there. And this is one part of the book, in my book, where I talk about being able to journey to your past lives. I also had an experience that I tell in the book about my contract. My contract is floating down, and I was able to review it and decide whether I wanted to change it at all, to revise it in terms of my life purpose for this lifetime.
You talk about loved ones who exist mostly in the middle world. That's where we meet our loved ones. And spirit mates. So is that equivalent to what are sometimes called soulmates on this world?
Yes. Excuse me. I have a part of my text where you are able to journey to meet with a departed loved one that you would call your life partner, your soulmate, the love of your life, your husband, your wife. And some shamanic practitioners say that you meet these beings mostly in the middle world. According to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it takes 40 days to transition from this bardic realm, or this realm that some people call purgatory or I call the middle world, that there are 40 days before you go upward, before you journey to the upper realm. I found this was very true of my husband, that I did meet him one time in the middle world. He and Jesus came and met me in my middle world, held my hands, and walked me along my path in the middle world. But from then on, I've only seen my husband in what I call a level of heaven in the upper world. Mm-hmm. I do know shamanic practitioners who say that some beings are in the middle world for 100 years. Up to 100 years. My grandmother, for instance, died before I was born, and I found her still in the middle world. But my husband, for whatever reason, it's different for each person, is in the upper world, is in what I call level of heaven.
You just mentioned a phrase I think that's important for all of us to keep close to our hearts when we work with this, is our personal version. All of these, what I find really interesting is that everybody has their own personal version, yet all of these versions include everybody else's version, so they all meet. And it's like we're all looking at something from the outside, and each perspective is slightly different, but we're all looking at the same thing.
Exactly. I love that you brought that up, because that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is for everyone to have their own individual experience, their own personal experience of these worlds, and to come back and really believe that this is real, that there is no death, that we are immortal, that your loved ones are fine. But you experience for yourself, Rick, your world is not going to look like mine. It's going to look like whatever you need. And these beings are going to show up in however way you need them to.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, you could say, oh, it's okay with me, just appear how you usually are. And they may just appear as light, or they may appear as these sort of wispy beings. But if you need it, and most of us do, they will appear in human form,
mm-hmm.
So that you need that. And pets, a pet that you loved that died could appear in, be bounding up to you, like my dog Rusty that I talk about in the book. So they're going to appear how you need them to, and this world is going to appear in the way that works best for you.
I've been speaking with Susan Allison. Her new book is You Don't Have to Die to Go to Heaven. Thank you for joining me, Susan.
You're so welcome. Thank you for having me, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.